The House Education Committee for May 8, 2017. Today we have an informational hearing on Senate Bill 182 and 183, and we've invited the Chief Education Office and others to discuss the Senate bills, since this was suggested by the Speaker's Office. And these bills passed out of the Senate Education Committee and went to the Joint Ways and Means. And so this informational hearing will kind of update the committee on what the bills will do so that when they leave Joint Ways and Means and go to the House floor, the House Education Committee will be aware of the bills. So that's what we wanted to do. Okay, so the anticipated speakers that we have today are Lindsey Capps, Colt Gill, Hilda Rosselli, and any others? Do we have some others to also?
Yeah.
Okay. So whoever's speaking, you guys can just split it up in whatever order you would like. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee, for the record, I'm Lindsey Capps, Chief Education Officer, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come today and present to you on our efforts around improving high school graduation outcomes. The Chief Education Office has introduced Senate Bill 182 and Senate Bill 183 in coordination with state education agencies, communities, and stakeholders in keeping with the charge of Oregon's equity lens to, quote, explicitly identify disparities in education for the purpose of targeting areas for action, intervention, and investment. And we want to talk to you a little bit more about that today. These legislative proposals will advance our shared efforts across Oregon communities to improve graduation outcomes and make ongoing progress toward achieving Oregon's vision and that of the governor to ensure that every Oregon student graduates high school with a plan for his or her future. Senate Bill 182 and 183 work in tandem to support communities and educators in having a greater impact serving our children and students least likely to graduate high school by developing coherent systems and practices that, strengthened by innovative partnerships and collaboration, will achieve and sustain long-term solutions to persistent gaps in achievement and opportunity. You'll hear in a second from Education Innovation Officer Colt Gill talk a little bit more specifically about Senate Bill 183. I want to make a couple of comments about that, in part to underscore, I think, the role that Colt has been playing in identifying and replicating high leverage practices proven to support student success. This is really reflected in Senate Bill 182, as it also reflects the voices of communities, as he reported on in his community engagement sessions, talking with over 1,000 Oregonians across 32 of 36 counties. These community engagement sessions reflected the commitment that you'll see in both pieces of legislation to engage communities, parents, teachers, and community-based organizations and their unique and important solutions to improving outcomes for our students and educational systems, which is also a principle of our equity lens. And a major theme expressed across these communities and participants was the need to focus resources more equitably for students and through the development and implementation of culturally specific, responsive, and sustaining practices. Senate Bill 183, on a more technical level, would provide establishes the Graduation Equity Fund to provide $20 million in targeted resources for communities to replicate and scale up these high leverage practices and improve graduation incomes for outcomes for historically underserved students. These are the students represented disproportionately among the 12,000 students who do not graduate high school on time each year. And these students include those with disabilities, students of color, students in poverty, students experiencing homelessness, and students living in tribal communities. Colt will talk a little bit about the three elements of this legislation that includes early indicator and intervention systems, a focus around regional approaches to addressing student attendance, and trauma-informed practices. I want to note that in doing so, much of the work that we foresee happening under Senate Bill 182 has had its roots in leadership here in this legislative body, not just in the communities that Colt heard from, but work that happened in 2015 under House Bill 4002 to develop a statewide attendance plan and through the Chief Education Office to do pilots around trauma-informed practices, which are underway in at least two of our communities across the state. The last bill that we'll talk about, and I'm pleased to have members of the body that created the legislation, is Senate Bill 182. One of the things that the equity lens talks about is that an equitable education system requires providing teachers with the support and tools they need to meet the needs of each student. And this means that we have to have and need to continue to pursue a long-term focus on supporting excellent teaching from pre-kindergarten through grade 12. Research consistently demonstrates that teachers are the most important in-school factor impacting student achievement. As Oregon's children and student population becomes more racially, culturally, and linguistically diverse, the state must support and cultivate a culturally responsive education workforce to serve them. Expanding opportunities across all Oregon communities to support early learning providers, mentoring for K-12 teachers, coaching and support for novice school administrators, and other professional learning and leadership supports for educators is critical. So we're excited today to have the opportunity to present these legislative proposals to you, to hear your questions and respond to them and begin a conversation that we think is extremely important for our state. We also believe and want to affirm through these proposals what they say about us as a state, that our values are demonstrated through resource allocation decisions. And these priorities and our commitments to not only students of color, but our rural communities, our English language learners, our out-of-school youth are critical, not just in the outcomes that we can have for them, but certainly the outcomes that we have for our state. And so with that, I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today, and we'll take any questions or hand it over to Colt Gill.
I'll just wait till the panel's done. Mr. Gill?
Great, thank you. I'm Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colt Gill, the Education Innovation Officer with the Chief Education Office. And I also thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit about Senate Bill 183, the Graduation Equity Fund. Like Lindsay shared earlier, components of this bill do build on previous efforts by this committee and also were developed, though, by local communities through these visits. They align with current statewide efforts to improve graduation outcomes that have been underway at the Oregon Department of Education and other agencies as well. Governor Brown has put forward a vision that every Oregon student graduate with a plan for their future. And she created the Education Innovation Officer position to help accomplish that vision. Currently, Oregon is not delivering at the same level as other states for its students or its own future. The national average for on-time graduation rates in this country is just about 83%. This is 2015 numbers. Oregon, performing third lowest from the bottom of the states, is about 74% in 2015. In 2016, it improved a bit. We got up to 75% of our students graduating on time, but we still have 25% that are not graduating on time after spending 13 years in our schools, kindergarten through 12th grade. And when you take a look at what that means, it means 11,665 of our students in 2016 had their future opportunities limited by our inability to help them earn a high school diploma on time. So if we don't innovate, if we don't take steps to change the way schools and communities support all their children, this trend of low graduation rates will continue because it has been going on for some time. We can count on failing about another 12,000 a year, year after year, unless we alter our approach. So that 12,000 at each grade level right now at risk of not graduating on time adds up to 150,000 students at risk, or 150,000 reasons to act now to change their lives. A strong focus on equity and targeting our resources is now critical, because of those 11,665 students our system failed to support on their path to graduation, they don't look demographically like the rest of Oregon. These are the statistics. Some of our historically underserved students show up on this list more represented than they do in the general population. Our schools are working for many students, but these numbers show they are not working for all students. The equity issue is not only clear in our current outcomes, but also in our future goals. So this chart of goals is from the state's ESSA plan that was sent to the U.S. Department of Education last week. This plan calls for 90% graduation rates for Oregon students by 2025. There are a lot of numbers on this page, so I'm going to pare it down a little bit to try to make a point. So if we look just to the goals for 2020, so having the year 2015 graduation rates as a baseline, look ahead 5 years from that, our goal overall is for 82% of our students to graduate on time, still not hitting the current state or national average, right? So that seems doable. It's an increase of 8 percentage points. It seems like that's something we could make progress towards, 2 or 3% a year each year towards 2020. It's when you look at the increases we need for all of our groups of students that you begin to see the equity issues here. So take a look at the African American students, for example. That's a 15 percentage point gain in the same time period. Students with disabilities, 21 percentage point gain. So we really need to think about our graduation goal overall, but also in terms of equity, and think of it as a pretty substantial lift for Oregon. I'm going to take a few minutes to share the details of the bill with you, but first I wanted to be clear that much has been done across the cradle-to-career system in recent years to tackle graduation rates. Schools are focused on the effort, and as a state, Governor Brown, the legislature, this committee for sure, the Chief Education Office, the Department of Education, the State Board of Education, have all taken several steps to improve graduation outcomes. I believe the Graduation Equity Fund builds on the efforts on this slide and is the product of a collaborative and cohesive effort with the Chief Education Office and ODE, local communities, districts, and other partners focused on improving outcomes. This summer, like Lindsay shared, I got to travel across Oregon in an effort to collect the diverse voices of citizens to help guide our collective efforts to expand and support our students. In meeting participants across the state, I found that they were very welcome, they were open, they were willing to share local and sometimes really personal stories and challenges to supporting their students on their path to graduation. These meetings were full of passion, celebration, and sometimes tears. Many communities have invested time, energy, and resources in highly effective practices to support students on their path to graduation. Participant perspectives and innovative local efforts provided powerful examples to guide state policy and partnership with communities and schools. So the entire report we sent to you all, so it's on the system, and it's also available at that link. Like Lindsay shared already, we got to visit with 1,000 people. They were students, they were parents, they were teachers, they were sometimes community members or people in the housing system or medical systems in our state health systems to share their ideas. The groups ranged in size, but typically they were what you saw in those pictures, so they were somewhere around 10 to 12 people at a time. We met for about 2 hours. We specifically sought out to overrepresent groups that are typically underrepresented in our systems in Oregon. So LGBTQ youth, tribal members, students of color, families navigating poverty, to ensure that those voices were heard. We focused on a couple of questions, which were, what are the barriers, those critical factors impacting high school graduation in your community, and what are some promising programs you've seen? We compiled the input and categorized it in a few ways in a report. We learned that across the state, there was a common need for a focus on equitable practices and outcomes. This came up in every single discussion we had. And for the development of strong relationships, partnerships, and relevance for our students. helping them feel like they belong in the school system and that the school system is relevant to their future. With these in place, we could implement a number of strategies that were shared with us around preparing students, supporting students, and engaging students and families on their path to graduation. In Oregon, part of our challenge is to identify economical and high leverage investments that align with local student, parent, educators, and community members so that their children can succeed. So Senate Bill 183 aims to implement some of what we heard across the state in a way that allows schools and communities to tap into resources and implement with local flexibility. And it really does three things. So it implements an early indicator and intervention system. It implements trauma-informed practices in more school districts across the state, and it implements efforts to curb chronic absenteeism. The early indicator and intervention system, if you're not aware of what those are, they're used by close to 30 other states. Many states and districts that have implemented these systems have seen year after year graduation rate increases of 2 to 4% that they attribute to these systems. They can appear like data systems, and part of it, the use of them is around data. Our schools use data today, but this uses data in new ways. It's called predictive analytics. It works in a similar way to the way that Amazon or Netflix is able to predict what you may be interested in purchasing next. So it goes beyond state test scores. It looks at a student's attendance, behavior, and academic performance in classes, and then it applies longitudinal data and research to predict whether a student's current data shows them to be on track for graduation or not. So this allows educators, students, and families to work together to intervene and support students before they are too far down a path that's causing them to be at risk to graduate on time. So it's not just a data system, it's really a communication system and an intervention system. It brings community focus to the goal of ensuring every student stays on a path to graduation. Second part is trauma-informed practices. These help students who have endured adverse experiences like a death in the family or hunger, or children who are part of a marginalized group in Oregon and have experienced discrimination or harassment. Trauma-informed practices alter the way staff interact with students. Excuse me, and helps the students feel as though they are welcome and fully included in school. So this is important in Oregon because we don't have the staffing for full wraparound services like some states provide. The current student-to-counselor ratio in Oregon is 1 to 602 versus the recommended ratio of 1 to 250. So to ensure our students are meaningfully supported in graduating from high school and moving on with a plan for their future, they need all staff to be effective guides and provide support systems such as restorative practices and trauma-informed practices along the way. Chair Doherty had already been a pioneer in championing trauma-informed practices through House Bill 4002. This effort tries to introduce these practices to more schools in Oregon. During those visits, a parent in Medford told me that we're missing this big time in our schools. Trauma-informed care and mental health care is really missing. To implement trauma-informed care, you go into the model thinking that all kids are dealing with things. All kids are going to be faced with challenges. More kids need help, and there are less adults to take care of them. Thank you. In school, we've learned that adverse childhood experiences adversely affect attention, memory, and cognition, reduce ability to focus, organize, and process information, create feelings of frustration and anxiety, and they result in lower GPAs, high rates of absenteeism, more suspensions and expulsions, and lower graduation rates. By providing training to all school staff, we can build adult capacity for understanding the effects of trauma, engage community partnerships to support students, implement systemic school-wide practices to better ensure that all students feel safe and welcome, and implement specific instructional practices that help students develop resiliency that can allow them to succeed in school and overcome obstacles in life. The last piece that Senate Bill 183 does is around curbing chronic absenteeism. The House Bill 4002 statewide plan for addressing chronic absenteeism was compiled by the Oregon Department of Education with collaboration from the Chief Education Office and regional partners, and has a focus on building positive relationships between schools, families, and communities, providing an engaging curriculum, implementing culturally responsive and sustaining practices, and developing partnerships between schools and community organizations that can help provide holistic supports to students and families. Senate Bill 183 ensures funding for the implementation of the House Bill 4002 statewide plan for addressing chronic absenteeism. In 2015-16, nearly 102,000 students in Oregon, more than one in six children, were chronically absent from school. Nationally, Oregon consistently ranks within the bottom 20% of states for chronic absenteeism. A parent in Warm Springs told me, "Many of the district staff don't know or understand our tribal people. A bridge divides us. When our kids go over the bridge, it is like they are in a different world. They are not seen." Senate Bill 183 aims to support students from all communities in Oregon. The Graduation Equity Fund also aligns closely to and builds on efforts already underway at ODE. Over the past year, Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor has been bringing together stakeholders and practitioners through his Graduation Advisory Committee. This committee's efforts are now being readied as a set of resources for school districts as the graduation blueprint, a set of practices, many of those aligned to the issues in Senate Bill 183, that will be published and shared with the districts in Oregon so that they can see how other Oregon districts have implemented evidence-based practices to improve graduation outcomes. I'm going to end with this quote from a community member in Redmond who said, "I believe that the single student-centric factor contributing to student graduation rates is that students don't feel as though they matter. Their cultural interests, dreams, and goals don't matter. Students perceive this from educators, administrators, parents, and others. Individuals in poverty, minorities, and others are repeatedly told by society that they don't matter. And unfortunately, in many ways, our educational system compounds this. After all, when you don't have much, everything you do have is magnified. If we truly want to improve our statewide graduation outcomes, we must focus on all our students, especially those who have been marginalized. The creation of a graduation equity fund can begin to target our resources and our strategies in a way that helps educators ensure that every student in our schools knows they matter, knows they are welcome, and knows that they want them to succeed." So thank you for your time. That's Senate Bill 183. I don't know if you want to do any questions now or wait for Senate Bill 182 and do them all together.
We do some questions now and then we'll wait for the other one. Okay. Representative Solman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this presentation. And I just had a couple of questions and comments. I know that our school district in Hillsboro has a motto that is knowing each student by name, strength, and need. Thanks. And that's really been a topic of conversation from the very beginning of the school year with all staff members and throughout. And that's something that really we look at focusing on. And so I appreciate this presentation. And I also, you had mentioned that longitudinal data, and you mentioned that, and I know that we recently saw something and talked about the system that was looking to be put into place. I'm kind of curious if that will weave into this and help you with guide that work. The student counselor ratio is disturbing. When we have such high numbers such as that, we tend to have situations where counselors are put into more of a reactive mode instead of a proactive mode. So much of this work that you're focusing on, it's extremely, extremely difficult, as well as for our teachers. The name, strength, and need is a fantastic motto to have, but when your class sizes are extremely high, it's very difficult. And then finally, on the Graduation Advisory Committee, I was intrigued by that. You said that it's from stakeholders from all over with Dr. Knorr.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yes.
From all over the state. And that are coming together and talking about successes and challenges, so that it's kind of like the work smarter, not harder. So you're not reinventing. People can work towards those programs in their districts. Is that really the idea? So that's all.
Yes, Chair Doherty, Representative Solomon. Yes, I'll start with the graduation equity, or mm-hmm. the graduation advisory committee of Dr. Knorr's. So they have been meeting a little over a year, and they do just that. So they look at successful practices in school districts. They use also, ODE puts out graduation research briefs each year around the time they release graduation rates. And those look at districts that have seen success in raising graduation rates or closing gaps in graduation rates. And I would invite Dr. Knorr is in the audience today, so mm-hmm. if he did want to add more to that, he can come up and while I address your other two items. So the student longitudinal database will be of service as we implement these programs. So what it will allow us to do is to track whether they're working it or not on a statewide level, on a district level, and on a school level. And they'll just much like the way they'll be able to tell us the kind of difference that full-day kindergarten made for our students. So we'll be able to use that to track in the future, and we're excited about that. The counselor ratio, completely agree with you. One of the things that we were really thoughtful about when we put together Senate Bill 183 was the cost. And we're asking for $20 million to do three major projects in Oregon and support districts in a systemic way around those projects. That $20 million would have a very small impact on the counselor ratio, but this gives many of our staff, from bus drivers through teachers and administrators, the kinds of tools they need to support students on a daily basis, and then to recognize when they need more significant support so that they can be sent to a counselor or a mental health specialist or to a community service.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My follow-up, because it just triggered the thing, is on the trauma-informed care. Some school districts are having some pilot programs and working in. So is that also part of that? Do you take a look at what some school districts are doing, seeing how that's working, to be able to model that?
Yes, Chair Doherty, Representative Solomon, exactly. So what this does is it builds on the pilots that were created under House Bill 4002, and it builds on the work of a few other districts in Oregon. So there are seven districts that are in a consortia. They represent districts all over the state of different sizes, as well as some work going on in Southern Oregon and in Central Oregon and in Northeastern Oregon, all working on trauma-informed practices. So we've been interviewing the other groups. We've been closely studying the groups that are piloted out of the Chief Education Office, pulling together the best work of each of those to develop a model for implementing in other districts in Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative McClain.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for all the work that's been done by both offices and everybody who's really worked diligently, including some of your counsels and advisors and folks that come in and give advice to you that are including practitioners and others. One of the things that I haven't been able to answer when people have asked me this question, and that is that in this particular Bill 183, and it's in Section 3, and it basically is talking about how the money is going to be set up in a separate account. And one of the criticisms that I've heard, you know, over the years is that we often silo money in a way that it makes it a little more difficult for individual local school districts to be able to actually hire those counselors or actually, you know, get the money per pupil in a way that they feel they can hire more aides or more culturally specific assistant and support. And so what is your answer for them on why it's necessary, again, to take away from the per pupil, you know, type of expenditure that we're giving out in the per pupil amount, and to actually put it into another very specific, very, you know, very precise, and I guess I would call it very narrow, you know, fund.
Yeah, absolutely. So Chair Doherty, Representative McClain. So I think there are a couple of reasons for that. So one of the reasons that we create a separate fund is to provide actually more flexibility in terms of when that those dollars can be allocated to a school district, so it can cross over fiscal years for those school districts as they develop their plan and submit that, so that that work can continue. These funds can also be added to by others. So as we implement trauma-informed practices, if there are others who want to donate to that cause, so if $6 million of the dollars from Senate Bill 183 go into the trauma-informed practices work, and some organization in Oregon says, that's work we believe in, it's systemic work, it serves an entire community, we want to invest in that work as well, then this is a fund that they can actually donate to and can accept donations. So that's a couple of the reasons why. The other one, I think, why it's set up separate from the state school fund or as a carve-out from the state school fund is so that this work can be set up and supported at systemically from the state level to provide structure, especially for small districts in Oregon that may not otherwise be able to do this. So one of these, the early indicator and intervention system, these are can be fairly expensive systems. And our top 25 districts in Oregon, so these are districts with about 5,000 students or greater, all probably could find a way to develop their own system. And they would look different district to district, but they could create a system that worked. Districts with fewer than 5,000 students, it would be very challenging for them to have staff available, time for that staff, and the dollars to invest to create a system. So we're talking about, you know, 170 districts or so that may not be able to access an early indicator system, an early warning system, which is also called for, by the way, in Measure 98. So this is a system they need to have in place so that they can teachers can meet with one another to support students. So it's a way to provide a structure and a system so that all districts have access to it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Cook, Madam Chair. And just to briefly comment before I get to maybe a statement slash question. Sometimes when it's if it goes into this state school fund rather than a grant program, if you will, school districts then have the opportunity to use that resources however they want. And I think that's what you were referring to, whether they want to hire a counselor. What I've noticed, though, throughout this process of school districts coming to us and letting us know what's at stake in terms of our proposed budget and what they're going to be cutting, a lot of what I see on those line items is equity-related initiatives and or positions. What that tells me is that it's an afterthought. It's a if we have the resources to do it, rather than what it should be, in my opinion, an integrated component that should have been integrated long ago, and instead just tells us the reality of our institutional racism and oppression. Anyway, so just the comments that went in on that one. On the other hand, for me, you know, my brief 2 years as an educator and then working with young folks, particularly people of color, students of color, what I've learned and I've tried to understand the education system, and what I've noticed throughout this presentation is that you're looking for systemic solutions, yet we, because of politics, we ignore the systemic or underlying root causes, whether that's the underfunding of education or whether that's the institutionally embedded racism that exists in our systems. And yet we're looking for solutions while ignoring the underfunding of our education system and at the same time not wanting or having the political will to really address the root causes that have existed historically. You know, the reason why we have local control, the reason why we see the marginal statistics of graduation and academic achievement by certain populations come from our deep-rooted history of racism and exclusion and oppression in this country, but also in the state. And those systems have not caught up in terms of evolving to fit the needs of our very diverse populations. So how do you, you know, like, I appreciate the work on the one hand, and on the other hand, how do you also then address or make sure to call out the things that we can't call, that we have underlying maybe not called out?
Chair Doherty, Representative Fernandez, I appreciate your comments. I'll address the funding issue first and say that in putting forward this particular proposal, it's a fairly modest investment that I think starts to establish some systems that ultimately address equity and improvement of student outcomes, really targeted at populations of students that have not been necessarily well served in all cases. But it was also predicated on us at least beginning the conversation around the K-12 state school fund at a CSL number, with the idea that through the process, through this legislative process, through the budget process, that there might be ways that we improve that, including dealing with structural issues that we have in our public finance system around revenue. So I think that's, I want to just address that one and say that I think we're in agreement that we have to do both in terms of supporting good practice and improving the ways in which we're supporting our educational system financially across the board, not just in K-12, but early learning through higher education. I don't know, Colt, do you have any comments around the specific issues around how we get at root cause? I think that's part of the reflective practice that we ask educators to do, and I think it's somewhat reflected in the Council for Educator Advancement recommendations. It's, I think, part of the work we're trying to get going, but I'll let you speak to that in terms of the graduation bill.
Yes, Chair Doherty, Representative Hernandez, I would say what you said was replicated in discussions across the state, you know, with representatives from over 32 counties, whether they were students or parents primarily, or any other part of our education system. The equity issue is brought up over and over again, and it's clear from the slides that it's clear in our data, whether it's outcomes or our future goals, that Oregon's graduation problem is to a substantial degree an equity problem. So part of this is not only thinking about how we fund our schools, but how we target the funding that we do have. And so what the Graduation Equity Fund aims to do is to take the beginnings at a state level, a small portion of these funds, and very clearly direct them towards services to the students that we have not been serving as well as we need to, if we want our graduation rates to increase and if we want to close gaps in those rates. The areas of the Graduation Equity Fund, whether it's the data so that we're catching these trends earlier in a student's career, whether it's trauma-informed practices so that we're interacting with students and families in a much different way than we do today, or whether it's chronic absenteeism, where we're trying to make sure that our schools really reflect their communities and are a safe and welcoming place for all students, and families feel like that's a place where they want their children to be. Okay.
If you've got more questions, I'm going to have to do them offline. I've got to be out of here by like at 4 o'clock.
Okay.
So sorry about that. And I've got some questions. Actually, it's about methodology. And you go through and you say, okay, this is the 50 states, and this is the graduation rate. My question is what method do they use to do that? I mean, you can't tell me that Iowa is more racially sensitive and has more money and all of these kind of things. And then you've got Alabama, which is four things, you know, underneath them. And so my question is, it used to be that if I had transferred from Beaverton High School to Tigard High School, I was considered a dropout at Beaverton High School, even though I was getting a diploma someplace else. And so my question is, of the 50 states, what is the methodology used? Do they all use 4 years? Do they all use transfers? Do they all use whatever? And so even though it's been used as a political tool about the graduation rate, which still ain't good, how much of it deals with actual issues and how much of it deals with methodology in the other states? is my first question.
Chair Doherty, I think it has a little bit less to do with methodology than it has to do with graduation requirements across states, which vary greatly.
So we've got some of the highest.
Oregon has some of the most rigorous graduation requirements of all states. So we require more credits. So we're tied with about seven other states for the highest number of credits. We require a demonstration of essential skills in reading, writing, and math. Many states don't do that any longer. So that's one area where each of the states are different still. Substantially, all states who, this is the four-year cohort graduation rate, and they are all using the same formula. Oregon, along with probably 35 or 40 other states, has a very high degree of integrity about how they count students and ensuring that they are using the proper numbers in that formula. So I feel pretty secure that Oregon's counting well and doing a good job in that. Let's leave it at that.
Because I think that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And then briefly, just two comments. First of all, we all know that to help graduation rates, it's got to start in kindergarten and, you know, go up something like on that. And then lastly, with the comment that you have up on the board, I think it's really important to look at, you know, how we treat all kids. And you know as well as I do, 40 years ago I could have told you what causes dropout rate. And it's the same sort of issues that we have now, because 40 years ago we still didn't have that much money for schools. And so when you start talking about, you know, investing in our kids when they're very, very young, making sure there is no dropout rate, going through and dealing with some of the issues, and whether it's race, whether it's poverty, whether it's reading, all of that kind of thing, to go through and do it. But the one thing about this also, where they say that, you know, we've been told by society that they don't matter. The one thing I do not want to hear anybody on this committee, or hopefully anybody in this body, talk about is failing schools. Because every time you say failing schools, what you are telling every single child in this state is that they are failing. Not the schools, but they are failing. And I would hope that that's the sort of terminology that we won't use anymore. Mm-hmm. We will go through to improve schools and make them better, but the kids aren't failing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just my comment. Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, just one quick comment here. Representative Hernandez has mentioned several times that racism and oppression are very difficult problems in our school system. And I know, I have no information to debate him on that. I don't know whether that is true or not. But I would say this on behalf of the representative and myself, that if racism and oppression are major problems in Oregon's K-12 system, we better know about it, and we better figure out something to do about it, because that sounds drastic to me.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We also had Hilda signed up, and I didn't know who else wanted to come up and speak.
Or 182. They're going to do 182 now.
Okay, now we're going to be doing 182. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
So good afternoon. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli, and I serve in the Chief Education Office and work on policy related to educator advancement. And I'm thrilled to be joined today by a number of members of the Council for Educator Advancement, which I will explain why that's so important. I also want to acknowledge that one of your own members, Representative Susan McClain, is a new member of the Council on Educator Advancement following former Representative Betty Comp's retirement. We'd also like to acknowledge that this bill is currently in the Education Ways and Means, and we also want to make clear that this is not something brand new. You have passed legislation back in 2013 that formed a network for quality teaching and learning. It did some wonderful things, and over the past two bienniums, it promoted supports for educators, and yet, as we see the need for continued improvement, we are bringing back to you some recommendations that are a lot of structural issues rather than a new fund. We have a protected educator advancement fund that is within the state school fund, and so the information that you're going to hear today is a result of the governor issuing an executive order last April requesting more recommendations to really think about how this network was being distributed and how the funds were really reaching everybody equitably and how we were addressing some of the needs that educators had, the priorities of educators. And so it is a pleasure that I'm introducing first, and please share where you're from and all of that, but the chair of the Council on Educator Advancement, Michelle.
Yeah, thank you.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to present to you SB 182 today. My name is Michelle Oakes. I am a National Board Certified Teacher. I am the chair of the Governor's Council on Educator Advancement, and I'm also the mentor program coordinator for currently Ben Lapine County and Sisters in Central Oregon. That was the picture of all of us. There were 17 of us on the committee, and it included teachers, administrators, community members, school leadership teams, as well as 8 members from the Office of Department of Education and Legislature. The council, as we were developing our 10 recommendations, we really looked with the lens of these 4 core themes. The first one being equity. The council recognized and was committed to helping close the opportunity gap and helping educators address and recognize barriers that existed within their own schools, within their own practice. And how do we, as educators, really support one another in creating welcoming environments for both our students as well as our families? We also know, as you mentioned earlier, Chair Doherty, about silos, that we have the silos, and how do we begin to align the systems and collaboration across our teacher continuum? Pre-service candidacy, induction, all the way into a teacher's late career. What does that look like? And then empowering teacher voice and leadership. That is essential. We know that those closest to the students really understand what is needed in the classroom, what impacts student learning. And so how do we have teachers at the forefront helping with decision making on education policy, as well as in their professional learning that they're being offered? The next is time. Time is valuable, it's priceless. And when we think about professional learning, we know that job-embedded, sustained, ongoing professional development is how educators change. And without time for collaboration, it'll just be what we've always done, which we call sit and get, which doesn't change practice. Elevating teacher voice and leadership. When I was asked to talk about this, the first thing that came to my mind was students. We know that when we ask students, when we empower students and we give them choice and voice, they become lifelong learners. They apply their learning, transfer their learning, and own it. The same can be said for teachers. When we give teachers empowerment and choice and voice, they do the same. I have one example. I am supporting a national board candidate teacher as she's going through national board certification. And she looked at her data of her children of her in her classroom. She has high poverty. She has several students with trauma. She has a very, very intensive third grade class this year. And she said, what do I need to do to support student success? So she started doing research into flexible alternative seating. She collected data on the during the first month of school and said, what is making a difference for these kids as she implemented different flexible alternative seating options? Her data showed that her students had much less wasted learning time in the first 30 days of school as compared to her other colleagues. As we talk about leadership, I have now connected her with five other teachers across our district who are dabbling in the same thing. But I wanted them to go back to the why, go back to the research and how it impacts kids. And she now has a leadership role in our district as we have multiple teachers investigating what does flexible alternative seating look like, sound like, and how can it influence and impact student learning. We also, as part of Teacher Voice and Leadership, are working on mentoring and induction for our first and second year teachers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We'll talk more about that later.
Okay. Chair Doherty and representatives, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is Anna Gomez, and I work for Oregon State University. I coordinate a state program that is, the name is Juntos, and it's we work with Latino families across the state. I do outreach and engagement for the university. And I, before I start with my 3 points here, I want to say that it's been a pleasure to be part of this work and the group. And it's been a year of... many of these conversations happening in our room, and important conversations like the one that you, Representative Hernandez, brought to the room. And I think that's what we tried to do with the time. It was building in all the points and across the work a backbone that is about equity, because it's the work that is going to prove that it's going to make the difference. And in order to build that success for the students that lately, that's the goal, working with the students. That's the center of our work. It's also working with the teachers and knowing that we don't have teachers by miracle, and you have to bring teachers to the career with the enthusiasm and with the dreams open to work with all our students and open their hearts and minds to change the future of those kids. And the way we were thinking in growing those teachers, it's building career paths that are open, equity open, to all our state youth that is willing to go to college and wanting to teach one day. But those, again, are not miracles, and we need to work in partnership with organizations, universities, institutions that are currently doing amazing work to bring students to the teaching career. And also, we need to support those teachers in the path, because after you starting, that's my office. I'm in the third floor in one of the buildings, and I see the students struggling every day, and they're looking for answers every day, like, why I'm doing this? Why this is my path? And you know how hard education is for all. It's not, it never ends. And the question that comes to all these students accessing college is, what is this for? And if we don't accompany that path with mentoring, we know that those teachers are going to be lonely in the schools. And after having those silos in the schools, forget about leadership and forget about progress and transformation of the system. So that's why career pathways is one of the key points for us. Equity driving high quality professional learning. It was a hard conversation, Representative Hernandez, and don't think that it was plain. It was really hard to have with many of our colleagues, because equity for people like me, it's not just a word. It's not a concept. It's our actions. Every day we have to prove it, that we're doing it with the kids, and not only with Latino kids or the African-American kids, but Native kids and all the kids that are living in different conditions, in diversity or in rural communities. So the equity driving path is bringing to the conversation the importance of having practices that are culturally relevant for our students. But nobody else can drive those practices if you don't know how to, if you don't know what you're teaching for. So we need to embrace that conversation with our current teachers and our future teachers about culturally relevant practices and support and mentor those professionals to actually bring the conversations to the classrooms. And culturally relevant practices are not only for the minority or the brown kids or the black kids. Those are for all of us to embrace a planet, a world that is changing and is demanding, requesting from all of us more understanding, more hope, and more conversations. And induction and mentoring, in this process, it seems to be to for me as an educator, this is the most important work. After you call teachers to become educators, what is next? And the next, the mentoring piece is fundamental. We believe that no less than 2 years is a requirement with this proposition, with this intention, because we know that the first 2 years are critical for those educators to actually believe and start building their careers. And for the kids to see collaboration in their schools, for administrators to receive the support from others. So this is... a year and a half, probably about that work, and I hope you believe that many people is investing heart and soul in this work.
So while I invite Randy Hitz and David Mandel to join me, I want to remind you all that you have in your box a full copy I sent to Alethea. In case you had not received this before, this is the full council report as well as a briefing. And I just have to say that this appeared in my box Friday from Education Week, and it is one of the most succinct pieces around what professional learning looks like now in today's world, and it's just so timely because it aligns with what we're talking about.
That's sitting on my desk.
Yeah, it's real.
And I'm going to have to go, but yes. Representative Hernandez is going to gavel us in and out. But the one thing I want to say, especially about with the idea of mentoring, we used to have a beginning teacher fund, and so we had mentoring. But again, when you demonize the teaching profession, and you say, oh, yeah, you know, if you can't do, you teach kind of thing. And this has been going on for a long time. So it's not only that, but also elevating the education profession, whether it be here or in across the nation, elevate it like we have a lot of the teachers in Europe, where it literally is up there with doctors and lawyers and judges and everything else. But it's a good profession, but it's also a profession that has never really kept people in there a long time. And there are lots of varied reasons for that, and hopefully your group can work on that to keep people in more than 5 years. So anyway,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Hernandez, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk with you. Representative Doherty, before, as you're leaving, I want you to know that what I'm about to say is exactly what you're talking about. It's because part of what we're doing, sorry, I'll just keep it for just a second, but did I say my name is Randy Hitz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education? But this is about elevating the profession, and that's what I'm going to talk about. We're looking at creating teams of teachers to address problems of practice, and there's a whole movement taking place. I'll let you go, Representative Doherty, but I just wanted to let you know that that's what I'm addressing here. Exactly what you're talking about, elevating the profession to not identify teachers as a problem, but identify teachers as those who can best address the problems of practice. So thank you for your comments.
You.
Yeah. So with that, well, if you're in business or if you've been in the healthcare field, you know about quality improvement, and we're beginning to implement quality improvement in the field of education now. I can take you to school districts or schools where they're getting teams of teachers, school administrators, others together to address things like tardiness or absenteeism or the graduation rate. They're asking them, rather than giving them something from the top, from a university or something, they're saying, how can we address this issue of absenteeism in our school or in our district? And the teams will develop plans and assess, you know, their effectiveness and continue to improve their practices. That's very respectful of the profession. Our role is to give them the tools and the time to do that kind of work. So that's the collaboration, the kind of work that we're talking about. I give you examples from school districts around the state that are engaged in this kind of work. Relatedly, in the next slide, has to do with partnerships with higher education and teacher preparation programs and getting teams of K-12 educators together with higher education folks. You're shaking your heads, of course. That sounds obvious, right? Well, we've done that forever in some superficial way, haven't we? Developing our partnerships in terms of student teaching. But we're digging much deeper now. We're working much more collaboratively with school districts to help recruit teachers and school administrators. Just to give you a quick example, in Portland State University, because of a collaboration in our school administration program, we went from a typical 20% diversity population in our educational administration cohort, the students that we brought in, to almost 40% this last year. Because we worked with our school district partners in recruiting people into the program. And we're doing the same thing in teacher preparation, working with our district partners to help us do a better job of recruiting, especially recruiting a diverse population. We're working with our district partners to create a much more intense clinical experience. And we're getting information from the K-12 educators in ways that we haven't before to really help us figure out how best to do that. And we're also figuring out, how do you link that student teaching experience to mentoring and ongoing professional development of teachers? Because what we really need is a seamless system where higher education is working with K-12 all along the line from recruitment into the profession to ongoing professional development. Thank you.
That's a perfect segue for David.
Vice Chair Hernandez, committee members, for the record, my name is David Mandel. I'm the acting early learning system director, and I wanted to thank you for this opportunity to talk about SB 182 and to talk about the early learning workforce. I have to say it's just really exciting to be part of this conversation, and the strong recommendations in support of the early learning workforce included in the Council for Educator Advancement report and in the content of SB 182 are really testament to how quickly and how far the conversation around early learning in this state has moved. I think all the comments that Chair Doherty was sort of making about the need to really recognize the role and value of teachers really applies some of those challenges are we feel even more intensely in the world of early learning, where I think 10 years ago it might have been standard for sort of people to refer those workforce as babysitters and not recognize strong foundations and the skills that go along with that work. But now I think there's really been a strong recognition of the importance of quality early learning experiences for putting young children on the path to success in school and life. And I think a growing recognition that quality early learning experiences are all about the quality of interactions between children and the adults who work with them. In Oregon, there's about 22,000 individuals who are working directly with young children in early learning settings. And I think it's also important to remember some of that is in schools, but most of what we're also talking about in terms of the early learning workforce is in Head Start programs, in community-based programs, in child care centers, and also a really important role of family-based child care in supporting our young children. The Oregon's early learning workforce is more diverse than Oregon's adult population, but slightly less diverse than Oregon's 0-5 population. And that's that diversity of that workforce is a real asset, and we have the opportunity to really build on that, but I think it also means that we need to be sort of thoughtful about those investments in the early learning workforce. These are incredibly dedicated folks who work long hours for little pay, and up until fairly recently, usually with little recognition. While we as a state and as a nation have come a long way in recognizing the value of early learning and its potential for long-term impact, our support for this crucial part of the education workforce has been very, very limited. Limited pay and opportunities for professional development, limited access to job-embedded professional development, limited access to professional development that is culturally specific and or in a language other than English. And where there are opportunities to earn a degree, they're often not set up in a way that actually makes sense for this workforce. SB 182 begins to address these challenges. Not only does it recognize the need to align and connect the supports for the early learning workforce with those of K-12, but it also recognizes the need to address the unique needs of this workforce, building educational pathways that for early learning professionals to access college credentials, degrees, and certificates, providing coaching and mentoring opportunities that address the broad needs of the diverse early learning workforce. increasing access to training and professional development that is culturally responsive and linguistically diverse. The Early Learning Division and Early Learning Council look forward to the partnerships and collaboration with the Council on Educator Advancement, with the Chief Education Office, and with HEC, and with Oregon's institutions of higher learning that this bill would help foster. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
So you might wonder, so what is the bill going to do? So one of the things that's important for you to realize is that we're joined also today by Monica Bean, who is a non-voting member of the council, as well as Salam Noor, Lindsay Capps. And this really is that seamless system that David was referencing. He was also a member of the group. And one of the things that's important to for us to think about is that as we looked at the network that has been operating, what we learned is that we had set up competitive grants that were very inequitable to small districts that did not have the personnel or the time even to write for grants. We also had not yet found a way to move away from what I call buckets. We had a mentor project. We had a collaboration grant project. We had professional learning bucket. And those had not been integrated. What we believe over time has to occur for these systems to really work is for us to integrate these together. And so what we're proposing is to keep the network in place right now during this coming biennium as we stand up a structure that really takes into consideration the practitioner voice moving up to us at the state level so that the next time, the next biennium, you would actually have a full set of priorities coming to you from the voices of educators in the field and in conjunction with families and students. We think that their voices also talk a lot about what has to happen to help educators be successful. So one of the things that this allows us to do is to also leverage resources in ways that we have not been doing it. We've contained it to basically primarily the resources that were in the network. What we realize is now with ESSA and Title IIA funds, as well as other grant and private and philanthropic resources, that if we leverage at each level, we can actually make the resources that the state has dedicated go farther and be able to be more equitably distributed across the state. We also, and this is what's interesting in this Education Week special, is that we're realizing now that the idea of bringing in experts from, you know, 50 miles away to do, quote, professional learning workshops is ignoring the fact that sometimes the very person that's in a school making something work needs to be facilitating discussion with other educators, because that's who they will listen to first off. And they can go to that teacher immediately and say, you know, I tried that, it didn't work. So what do I do now? Which doesn't happen when the workshop leader has left. In addition to that, we've talked about how this bill would be able to transition the existing network and the existing network funds. So when you see the language of the bill, you'll notice that it's talking about, oh, now it will be an educator advancement fund. It's not really different. It's a designation for us that we've made these coordination changes. But it is the same network fund that you have been funding through the amounts in the state school fund. What we also believe that this bill will allow us to do that is new is it will establish a new scholarship fund that is set up primarily to help us do a better job of supporting culturally and linguistically diverse teacher candidates who are on their way to becoming teachers, but who often are stymied by the high costs of higher ed. We studied six states to come up with a plan for how we could do this. We're working closely with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and the Office of Student Access and Completion. They will be helping to facilitate that process in making those funds available to candidates. If you think about the fact that many of our most diverse candidates now are starting at the community college, where they might be able to combine their Pell, Oregon Opportunity Grant, and Oregon Promise, and then they're transferring into programs either at the undergraduate or graduate level into their education degree, though having a special scholarship just for them when they get there is going to go a long way to helping them enter the profession without an armload of debt over their heads. The second thing that this allows us to do is to do a better job of teasing out what are we learning from these investments. We believe that the TEL survey is one indicator that tells us about the teaching and working conditions of our educators. We've now issued it twice. We're planning for 2018. That's the kind of data that the council will be looking at, as well as evidence about teacher retention and student outcomes through metrics that the council will actually define and hold everybody accountable to. We're also looking right now at high learning standards around what professional learning looks like and digging into what this culturally responsive professional learning really looks like. We have people all over the state that think they're doing it, and yet we've never had a convening that says, well, how do we define that? Who's doing it? Where do we map that? And where are our needs? Lastly, you'll notice in the amendments that are going to be coming forward that when we met with Ways and Means Committee chairs, we found that there were ways we could clarify the bill to be clearer about what's going to happen in 17-18, what happens in 18-19, and then what happens in 19 through 21. So those are some technical changes that you will see that will be coming back from Ledge Council, and we'll be forwarding that. They'll be posted, obviously, through OLIS. I just want to say that the opportunity to work with this council has been amazing, because I'm surrounded by people who care deeply about what happens in classrooms every single day, and I'm reminded that the solutions are within our reach, but we have to find ways to activate their voices and bring their perceptions to the table. So we'll be glad to answer any questions that you have at this time, and thank you very much for the opportunity to share with you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the panelists on SB 182? Representative Solman.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hernandez. Thank you so much, and I'm going to have some comments embedded in here with some of my questions. I wanted to say about the cultural responsive education.
Culturally responsive practices.
Practices. Mm-hmm. I knew that was right. I could not agree with you more. I recently, just this weekend, had met Alter Wiener. He's a Holocaust survivor, and he goes around to a lot of schools throughout Oregon and really discusses his story, which is incredibly impactful. And so, you know, and I really believe that understanding our past really helps us from, you know, today and in the future. And so I just appreciate having that, that you're bringing that into the conversation and making sure that those are addressed. The scholarship opportunities for teachers, fantastic, because when you talk about teacher retention and the fact that you want to keep our teachers in the classroom, the fact that they not only are burdened with, you know, class size, they're burdened with being new teacher, but also that they have such an incredible amount of debt that they have to pay. My future daughter-in-law is a second-year elementary teacher with about $90,000 in debt. And started out at private college and went to state school. And she's a second year elementary teacher. And so we need to do better by really looking at all sorts of things, not only alleviating that debt, but also looking at course alignment so that those classes are not wasted or not invested. So I appreciate that conversation, because I think that weighs on so much, not only for our students, but our economy. Those students are not buying houses or cars, right, or, you know, so on and so forth. I also want to say that I'm so excited to talk about having these conversations, because I attended the Oregon Business Summit in December, and I really fully expected to go there and hear the conversation about business bottom line and everything else. The subject was education, all the way from pre-K on to college education and the importance and what that does to help generate stronger business economy. And so I am completely inspired that education is getting exclamation points in a lot of the discussions that we are having. I wondered about, I knew I had questions. I wondered about the teacher mentoring. Fantastic. Again, my future daughter-in-law says it's a game changer for her to have that mentor. So are there statistics that look at what our retention rates are in mentoring programs and those that do not have? Could we maybe even look at a system that could set up mentor districts, especially when you're looking at small districts that, you know, say these programs are working and how? And then finally, last one, You mentioned the struggling with professional development for small districts. Could that be coordinated like through our ESDs so that those small districts could, you know, have that source there that could be the resource for them? That was a lot, I know, and that's the way I roll.
Vice Chair Hernandez and Representative Solomon, those were all excellent questions, and I'd like to take the mentoring one first. What is fascinating about what happens right now in our state is that we have about 31% of the people who said they were new teachers and were able to be fortunate enough in a district that did write a competitive grant that was awarded funding, got a mentor program. And it was a highly developed program based on high standards with trained mentors and terrific resources. What we know in studying mentoring since 2007, when you first started funding projects, is that we see retention for people who are able to access that. But currently, because of insufficient funds and because some pretty tight parameters on how we've, you know, made these funds available, we still have a lot of people who are thinking they're getting that state mentoring project, and they're really getting maybe a hybrid, maybe a little bit. And who knows, there could still be some people who have somebody stop by and say, how is it going this week, Randy? I'm down the hall if you need me, versus a really well thought out plan. So we've written a couple of fine-tuned details that would help create a little more flexibility, but also target the state funds, particularly for people who are new to the profession. We believe that mentoring should be differentiated. If I'm coming from Idaho and I've taught 8 years, I don't have quite the same needs as somebody who is brand new, first time ever setting up a classroom. True, the district should still provide me some supports, but if we have limited state funds, let's target those first to the people who are new to the profession. Secondly, I just want to talk about the professional learning for smaller and rural areas. We think that we have not yet moved into the 21st century of really utilizing technology in ways that can connect people better. We did, through the network, create something called the Oregon Educator Network, but it is more of a social network right now. It doesn't have enough oomph to stand up as a platform to support learning that you could access if you're in Glide or Ontario or Coos Bay. So that is part of what we're looking at with professional learning, and then creating these networks of practitioners to stay in touch with each other, because it is not enough to just say, well, I went to a workshop and now I know how to do it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative McClain.
Well, first of all, I really want everybody on this panel to know that you've got volunteers out here that have just spent, you know, 2 hours with us and have come away from their own personal jobs to come and give their extra time. And I really find that to be incredible, and really I want to thank you so much for all the work you've been doing for the last 15 months and more on this different committees that you've been sitting on. And secondly, though, it was just exactly what was just discussed on some levels. I support absolutely everything that has to do with 182, and I think I support everything that has to do with 183. But there was an answer that was just given to Representative Solomon about the fact that we had insufficient funds for some programs, and we somehow didn't make them available in the way they were most useful. And so that was what I was trying to get at with my inarticulate question, which was just, you know, as I read the new bolded language on this bill, I wanted to make sure that we're getting what you're hoping for in the amendments, which is to let us know what that transition looks like in the bienniums for the next two or three bienniums. And then also, you made another really, I thought, insightful comment, and that was that it's how the structure is. If it's an informal social structure, that's one thing. If it's a limited mentoring structure, that's something else. But with the goals that you have, and the blue book that she showed you, I think that's really valuable to really get at the goals and the aspirations of the programs. How do we make sure that we don't limit ourselves by putting us in a concrete box somehow? And so, you know, we've got the Common School Fund, we've got the State School Fund, we've got all of these different programs, we've got, you know, different folks making some decisions on different aspects of professional growth. And so I think that's the question that I was trying to get out there, was you know, how could I, what can I do? I want to be the cheerleader on all the ideas that you have. But are we sure that we have this in a form that it's going to allow us, even if we, our needs in the future change, can we still see this being the right funding? I get the gifts. I get the, you know, try to get more people to put more money into this program. That's great. And if we have to have a separate fund because of that, well, that's a good reason. But just making sure, again, that we're not siloing this money in such a way that it's going to be, you know, some kind of impediment for us in the future to not be able to achieve some of the things you want in this transition. So I was glad to hear you say that about the amendments.
I just would add one thing, Vice Chair Hernandez and Representative McLean. One of the reasons that we slowed down the timeline for the council was that we really wanted to do this right, not rush into something. If we had brought you legislation that immediately, you know, in July, whatever, August, shifted over to a completely different process of allocating funds and addressing priorities of educators, we would not have done the work that is needed to build the local level supports and the voice opportunities for educators to say to us. So we think that by 1921, what you receive in terms of priorities are coming from the people who are in those practitioner roles. And I think it also allows us to be nimble enough to look ahead at the next 2 years and say, what is coming down the pike that is really important? I, for one, you know, 5 years ago, you did not see professional learning around trauma. You know, so the field changes, and even the delivery systems are changing now. So this allows us to be nimble and to be a little more responsive by listening to what educators are telling us. I will tell you also that when we looked at the results of our over 18,000 educators that responded to the TEL survey, what we learned was that many of them felt like, when I go to a professional learning opportunity, I evaluate it, but I don't know whether or not anybody ever takes that into consideration to improve processes. And so this builds that cycle of iterative, continuous improvement into it. Thank you.
Is there any other questions? I have a question before we close. I'm glad to hear that the early learning is a part of this. One of the things that I've heard recently has been that the Head Start and pre-K folks, in terms of the requirements for what we want to see in their education and in their certification, is that there's fears that we may exclude certain communities, particularly those that have had access, an easier access to those jobs, and therefore much higher rates of diversity in that workforce. How do we make sure to retain those current educators? And if we raise the bar, how do we take on the responsibility of retaining them and furthering their education while they maintain their positions?
Vice Chair Hernandez, I really appreciate that question, and I really think that's at the heart of some of the goals of the early learning section of this bill. We know that the professional development support for the early learning workforce really makes a difference for outcomes for children and families, and we know that this workforce has incredible diversity to it right now, but we also know that the professional supports, particularly when it comes to access for degrees, are really quite often not very well set up to work for people who are working with children 10 hours a day and things like that. We've had some really successful pilots thanks to the innovation grants that the legislature passed in 2013 to where we worked with two consortium of community colleges and developed supports where you were working with a cohort of early learning professionals, of you know, child care providers, and working with them to really provide the not just the sort of navigation through the system and the kind of supports mm-hmm. and opportunities for those providers to work together. And it was, and those consortiums really proved quite successful at, you know, in I think two of the examples of moving cohorts of Latina providers into an AA program, into a two-year degree program, and working towards an AA degree. So we have some models that the funding attached to this bill would really build on that are really intentionally focused on making sure we build on the diversity of the workforce and not have professional development and the push for higher degrees, which I think is really important in terms of professionalization, end up mm-hmm. pushing people out of the workforce. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really at the heart of what we're trying to accomplish. And those have been really some both challenging and important conversations that we've had over the last couple of years of how do we simultaneously raise the status of the profession but also build on the great and dedicated folks who are already working in the profession.
I'm glad to hear that that's a goal. Is there any other questions before we close? All right. So with that, I close the informational session on Senate Bill 182 and 183. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay, we're going to close the House Education Committee on May 8th, 2017. Thank you. The House Education Committee on May 8th, 2017. Thank you.